pale horse. The man who sat on him was death. And hell followed with him.
You're killing me, man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Declarations of War. Your ears are not deceiving you. This is Alexei Vakard, just on a different microphone. Declarations of War Mobile Edition. As always, I am your host, joined by my co-hosts, Artemis Albosa.
Howdy, howdy.
And Levitane.
We're back, baby.
We are back. I appreciate everyone's patience. Alec, IRL update. I am moving. That's why we haven't had episodes lately. I literally have not been able to record the previous 2 weeks. I didn't have my stuff, didn't have the setup. I still really don't have the setup. The good mic is in a box somewhere. I've got a computer set up in a hotel room at the moment. But soon we will have a new lair, we'll have a new audio setup, and I cannot wait to broadcast to you from sunny Southern California. Really quick plug for our sponsor for this podcast, Yin Tan. If you listen to Declarations of War, you're most likely interested in big, colossal clashes of fleets that dominate EVE PvP. And if you've ever thought about leading one of those fleets, or are curious about why those FCs tell you to press F1 against that target, or this other target, and you want to understand what goes on there, check out Yin Tan's channel for fleet and solo PvP commentary. It walks you through the steps of getting into and winning fights in EVE. Check it out, youtube.com/yintan, no apostrophe.
It is some genuinely good content there. And he's been rather prolific as of late, too.
He's been putting up a lot of videos, and not that his production quality was bad before, but I noticed that he's putting a really, really noticeable effort into graphics and kind of the visuals that he brings to his already great knowledge and content in that area. He's like, there's transitions and highlights, and I've been really impressed lately. I don't know when exactly he started doing that, but I noticed like his previous two videos, I was like, oh wow, these are like pro looking. And as far as his talent, I mean, if you've been a long time listener to the show, you know he's been a co-host. He's an extremely skilled FC, definitely knows what he's talking about, and has an excellent communication style. So if you're at all interested in that kind of thing, highly recommend you check out his channel and thank him for sponsoring this show. And speaking of Yin,
I also find it amusing that he has a massive American flag hanging in his bedroom. It's like in the background of whenever you see his camera, but he is 100% British.
He would emigrate if he could, I'm sure. He knows where the freedom comes from. And speaking of Yin, the CSM. Yin, a many, many times CSM representative, one of the most CSM representatives to ever CSM representative. It is election time. If you're hearing this episode, you have about a day or two left to go in and pick your picks for the CSM. It's been a really interesting, kind of controversial field. I have this reversed in the show notes, but I think we should talk about this going into it, because this kind of did set the tone for this. There was a big controversy with the CSM and Brisk Rubal, which we covered on the show. Brisk was kind enough to come onto the show and give us a first-hand account of what went on. The short version is CCP publicly accused him by name of essentially insider trading of sorts, using his CSM position to export confidential information to other players so that he and they could make money that other folks wouldn't be able to do. Now, this was apparently totally false. Did not happen. CCP claims at the time they investigated ahead of time, and then they reinvestigated and were like, oh, whoops, better put out a retraction. Now, in the process of doing this, Brisk, who is a lawyer in his real life, was put in a pretty awkward position. Those kinds of accusations could damage not just his career in the CSM, his career in EVE, but also his real life career. That's not great. And now this story is associated with him. You know, whenever you Google it, it's kind of hard to get rid of that kind of thing. At least one candidate dropped out. Someone that had been running for forever, Commander Hayes. It was very interesting to see, or at least keep an eye out on, like, how many candidates would follow suit. And would we get the same quality of candidate this time around that we usually did, with people now more concerned than ever of tying their real-life identity to the CSM process? Artemis, you surveyed a pretty wide range of the field. Do you think this had the kind of impact we thought it might at the time?
So I think it did for one portion of the candidacy, right? For those who do significantly tie their real-life character to their in-game character. But I think for the field that ran, and indeed a lot of people who I interviewed or talked to the people who did interview them, it actually had the opposite effect. So all of the drama and the intrigue and the attention that the CSM got as a result of this controversy, and indeed the way that it showed the ability for CCP to make mistakes and the need for a player advocacy group to have some oversight over CCP and to be able to say to them, hey, this may be a bad idea, you probably shouldn't do that. I think all of that sort of actually increased the motivation for candidates who did not tie their real lives to their in-game lives to run for the CSM. I think a lot of people, or I can't say a lot of them, it was certainly at least a vocal minority of candidates who I interviewed were very much like, yes, the Brisk controversy, it got it in my mind, it pushed me to not be more afraid of running, but to actually want to run more and want to win more, because now I see there is a definite need for the CSM. And I also feel like the controversy, I want to say that it's kept the CSM more in the mind of the player base. And so if I were a betting man, I would bet that we have a higher voter turnout this year than last year, despite the fact that many would argue that the player base has declined between the 2 years.
I don't know if the raw numbers will be there. Percentage-wise, I think you're probably right. That's really interesting that candidates were mentioning that specifically. If you are not a fan of Talking Stations, you may not be aware, but Artemis actually went in and interviewed a fair number of these candidates, of which there were 44 total, which I don't know exactly what the numbers were for previous years, but that sounds pretty much on par, like in the 40-45 range. I think one year we had 60, but I think that was an outlier if I'm remembering right.
I think it was like CSM 10 or something. There were a stupid number of candidates just because it was like CSM 10 and the CSM was at its lowest point, so controversy was at a high. Everybody's like, I'm going to run and I'm going to change the CSM and yada, yada, yada. But as far as the interviews are concerned, it wasn't just myself and TIS. Well, first of all, I didn't do all of the interviews. I had a massive team doing a lot of work to help me out. You can go ahead and check out all the interviews by all the dudes who did them. And then we also had people on the back end helping me with the editing, helping me contact candidates, all sorts of stuff. So it wasn't just me. There was a whole team doing it, and it wouldn't have happened without them. And then we talked about Yin Tan's content on his YouTube channel. He himself also did CSM candidate interviews. And if you take his interviews plus the interviews that TIS did, because he got some that we missed, we got a bunch that he missed, we surveyed over half of the candidates. We got all of the ones, or at least TIS got all of the candidates who we could contact through Discord and who were interested in an interview, barring one mistake where we thought we contacted them, but it turned out we didn't. And then they found out that they weren't contacted, got super salty. It's a big mess. In any case, everybody that we could contact, we did. We got in total between Yin Tan and TIS over half of the field has some sort of interview online that you can access, which I think is fantastic, but I want to beat that for next year. Next year, I want like 75% at a minimum is my goal, but too far in advance.
Well, you know, it's also a compressed time frame for that kind of thing from when they announce the candidates to like, oh shit, we got to get them all scheduled. I've been there.
Yeah, one of the things we tried doing was interviewing people ahead of time. So we went through the list of people who were posting their candidacy stuff. Because the way that it works is CCP will let you apply. And then after a few weeks of applications, they go through and approve everybody, right? They check their passports, they check their IDs, they make sure that you're a real human being with a real identity. And there was one case, like with lucrative business opportunity, everybody thought that character was a joke. Like, nobody thought that was a legitimate candidate. Even, like, his campaign thread on the Eve forums was locked at one point, because I think the CCP moderators thought it was a joke. But then he got approved. And the other thing was, there were a couple of candidates who... There was one candidate who we thought for sure would make it through, who didn't. And actually interviewed this guy. We thought he was safe enough to interview him, spend the time and effort, and then he didn't make it through.
Yep.
And there were a couple of other candidates which, just out of the blue, they didn't make it, but CCP would not tell them why. So maybe that's something to look into in the future, is a bit better communication between CCP and the CSMers who are applying, or the hopeful CSMers. But it was,
that's been
it was
a persistent problem.
Watch how the field sort of changed.
I forget whether it was 8 or 9. There's a CSM where there's a very prominent, high-profile candidate that was going to run and wasn't able to for passport reasons. But, you know, it was the kind of issue where, like, you should have known ahead of time, but I guess he thought things would work out. And I remember that I, like, moved heaven and earth, not really, but close to it, to try to get content for around him and get him scheduled, like, all that stuff. And then he wound up not even being on the ballot. And I was like, oh, fuck. Never doing this again. Approved candidates only. But, you know, that does have its downsides. Like you mentioned, you can't interview people ahead of time, and then, you know, that list comes out, and you only have so much time to realistically get people. And apologies to the audience this year for us not doing CSM coverage. We will be back next year, certainly. It just did not work out in terms of my move and some RL work situations. Couldn't come together this year. But fear not, next year we'll definitely be doing some. This year, however, you are pretty much just going to have to settle for our picks. Now, I'm not going to lie, I did put legitimate business opportunity on my ballot. I never vote for candidates like that, but he won me over. He was not my top, though. It was literally my bottom. But I had to put him on there. Lave, who was the top of your ballot for you? If anyone in our audience has not yet voted for the CSM election, there's going to be a link in the show notes. I strongly, strongly encourage every single person listening to take the time and vote for at least one candidate. Who was your number one?
Before I do that, I would absolutely agree. Now, guys, if you do not express your vote, your voice is wasted. So even if you absolutely hate certain people, vote for the other guy, but at least put your hat into the ring and make your vote count. For me, it came down to a candidate that didn't represent null blocks, because the current CSM is predominantly made up of one alliance or coalition. That's the Imperium. So the CSM currently has the nickname the GSM, the Goonswarm Stellar Council, whatever it is. My pick goes to Olmeca Gold. This is a player who has been quite a thorn in Delve for the past couple of years right now, and we've certainly seen some of his work while doing some of the guerrilla warfare stuff down there that we do with the Honey Hunters. Big shout out to you guys, by the way. There is a great YouTube video out there called The Wailer, EVE Online, The Wailer. And I strongly advise people, if they are interested in EVE, even if it's just as a passing interest, to watch this, because it is very interesting and gives you a good idea of what this player does. He effectively has built a game style around what he does, and that's not a common thing you can say. It's very rare you see that.
Yeah, like, I mean, Brisk, I think, has the best CSM campaign commercial of all time. But if I had to pick a runner-up, and it's a bit long form, but that Wailer video for Olmeca, it's hard not to watch that and go, wow, this guy absolutely needs to be on the CSM.
I mean, regardless of his candidacy for the CSM, like, if you just stop watching that video at the last 2 minutes when he talks about running for the CSM, it is just a fantastic video. Like, that is peak EVE PvP video form content, in my personal opinion. Because he's got a good mix of, this is what I do, this is like highlights of the crazy stuff I was able to freaking pull off doing it, and this is how I did it. And it is a phenomenal video. Like, even if you don't like him, you don't like his posting on Reddit, or you don't want to vote for him for the CSM for whatever reason, just stop watching at the last 2 minutes, but watch the rest of the video, because it is genuinely fantastic.
And it also goes into why he tried some of the things that he tried, like, and why he pivoted tactics, and it kind of got into his mental mindset. And that, I think, was the most impressive thing to me. I mean, obviously, some of the feats and highlights are pretty amazing, but I loved the thought process that went into it. And I think you're right, it is peak Eve. It's not only the out-executing your opponent, but also a bit of metagame, also a bit of master mechanics knowledge, also a bit of taking those mechanics in an entirely new direction and breaking them in ways that are really unique and probably weren't really thought about. And that's the kind of player you need on the council. You need at least one player like that, that goes, looks at something and can go, all right, well, if it did it this way and this way, and then combine it with like micro jumps and this other mechanic over here, this thing is possible. Is that what we want to be doing? It's super useful to have that guy, that technical expert.
It's the wild card or anything else. I mean, there's going to be loads of people are experts on null security and whatnot, but he's created a playstyle, and certainly he's attracted people down into that area to do things that were previously felt inconceivable. One of the big things I might say recently is, ever since the whole war started between Imperium and the North, watching Goon Titans die in 1DQ outside their Keepstar would have at one point been felt unthinkable.
Pivoting back a bit to the needing that one person on the CSM to do that sort of thing, I was rather disappointed to see that Cetonia, who in years past, indeed in this last CSM cycle, sort of filled that need, in my opinion, wasn't running this year. And I never saw an explanation as to why. It was personally disappointing to me, but I suppose he has his reasons.
I would never question anyone deciding not to run for a second term, especially if you're super engaged in the CSM. It can be exhausting. I personally question more why Steve Runikin is still running. I don't know if he's just like got incredible bounds of spiritual energy, or if he's like not really doing anything and that's why he's getting out of these terms unscathed. It's got to be one or the other. Speaking of, Steve is also a great candidate. If anyone out there is especially into industry or EVE coding, EVE third-party tool development, or you're a big fan of those tools, Steve Runikin has got to be your biggest possible advocate. But he was not my pick. My number one pick. When I saw his... I didn't realize he was running again. When I saw his name in the candidate list, I double-clicked immediately. For me, there is no other top guy, Mike Azariah. Art, this is your pick as well.
So I have a few asterisks to add to that. So
okay.
As a result of me doing all of the interviews, right, I am being as neutral as I possibly can surrounding the CSM. And so I have not published a ballot anywhere. I have not endorsed any other candidates. And I have actively, like, I will interview literally anybody I can interview. There was no agenda. There was no, like, actively trying to avoid certain candidates or making it difficult, giving somebody a particular interview or yada, 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 right? It was entirely, we want to get as much CSM content out there so that our listeners could make informed voting decisions. So I will say, as in years past, I did not fill out all 10 slots in my voting ballot. That is because I vote based on people who I think would be good on the CSM. And if I don't think a candidate would be a good CSM member, I won't vote for them, even if I think they are less bad than other candidates. I won't pick the least bad candidate just to fill up my ballot. So it's a coincidence that I only voted for 7, similar to how I did last year, but I did only vote for 7. And I will say that I endorse Mike Azariah explicitly because of his interaction and constant push, even years in the past, before CCP had the motivation to focus on the new player experience like they do now. He has been a constant advocate for the new players, constantly working with the Magic School Bus program, has a ton of incredibly useful knowledge, and has been on the CSM in the past in more troublesome years. So for those reasons, I feel comfortable endorsing Mike Azariah, despite my desire to remain neutral in this campaign.
I have no such neutrality requirements. I give him my full-throated endorsement. I supported his candidacy when he initially ran, because he had this wide-eyed optimism about the game and a true love for new players. We did interviews with him and stuff, and it really shined through, that passion. It's been years. He still has that passion. He still has that care for new players. And it's not wide-eyed optimism. He's now experienced, but he still has that hopefulness about him. And he loves this game and loves everyone that plays it. And, I think that in the state that EVE is in now, I don't want the CSM to be super pessimistic. Obviously, CCP needs to face some hard truths about EVE. I think my opinion on that has been pretty clear the past couple of shows. But that doesn't mean that the players have to always approach things cynically. I think we want to, in some ways, inspire CCP as well as inspire each other. And I think Mike does that. He's got that balance of the passion and the balance of the experience. And he is focused on new players, which is where we need growth. But he is not, at this point, a new player himself, so he gets the veteran struggle as well. So I have nothing but love for him. I've met him a couple times IRL at various events. He's a tremendous dude, a great speaker, always has time for everyone that comes up to him to talk to him. So 100%, 110% support for Mike Azariah. Super recommend him. Azariah, Olmeca, I think those are really good top two candidates. There are many others that are worth your vote as well. We're going to be including the link to the voting, and we'll have the candidate list there. Like we mentioned, Yin Tan, Artemis, both have done interviews, so if there's a candidate you're not sure about, you want to dive deep, you want to get to know them a little bit more, those are great resources for you. And if you haven't voted before, we should cover the mechanics. The way it will work, I forget the exact name for this, the single transferable vote, I believe it is. You'll pick 10 candidates. If your top one already gets voted in or already gets eliminated, your vote will still count. It will just go to your next stated preference.
It's a bit different than, like, if you Google the Wikipedia article for a single transferable vote, it's not a one-to-one match, so if you want to know the specific details on how EVE's CSM system works in particular, you can go and check out Noisy Gamer's blog, and he has a fantastic post that goes in-depth how specifically the EVE CSM version of the single transferable vote works. But essentially, it is such that none of your votes are wasted. You will never waste a vote if you are voting for people that you want on the CSM. And order does matter, so it's important that you get the order, relatively speaking, the way that you want it to be because of the way that it works, if I understand properly. But definitely, like, if you want to know the more details, go check out Noisy Gamer's blog.
Yep, the order definitely matters, but, you know, I think once you get down past five, maybe a little less so, but your first top five candidates, I would put a lot of thought into that. And then beyond that, put people on there. Like you said, Artemis, if you think they're going to be good in the CSM or good for the game, put them in there. Give them your vote. Doesn't matter if you think that they're a shoe-in. It doesn't matter if you think they have no shot. Vote your heart, basically, and it will count one way or the other.
It's also worth noting that CCP has made it very easy to vote across multiple accounts. So it will, I don't know what sort of web development magic it uses, but it will remember what candidates you voted for on a previous account when you log back in on the same computer in the same browser. So basically, you just do all your accounts at once, log into the first one, vote for your candidates, log out, log into the next one, and it will have all of those candidates in that same order pre-selected in your ballot. So all you have to do is click vote, log out, log in, vote, log out, log in, vote. It's phenomenal.
It's also a bit disturbing, I think, that... I mean, there's I'm not too concerned by the fact that the technology allows you to remember things. That's, you know, that's a website thing. But I've always been a bit uneasy regards to the fact that people with more accounts have more of a voice. That doesn't strike me as fair in a truly kind of representative system, because certain entities that will have game styles and setups of play that encourage or are really suited to multi-boxing, so corporations or entities that are very high on crabbings with multi-boxing Rorquals and other ships like that, that one person may have 16 votes, whereas I, as a PvP player, will have 3 accounts. I don't do any kind of crabbing on that. I only have 3 votes, and his voice is worth 5 times mine.
Yeah, it seems odd to make that easier.
I mean, I get, obviously it's per account, and I'm not quite sure exactly how they would enforce it the way. I mean, ideally I would have it per person. Ideally have it, you know, a unique, you know, one vote per person. That way it'd be far more representative, but that's
I don't
just
think
me.
CCP can actually track people. I think that's the question.
I would.
Like, they don't really have a good sense of who's who.
The problem isn't that it's easier for multiple account voting. I think the problem is that even its current state has functions in it that makes it beneficial for you to have 50 accounts, right? With freaking multi-boxing Rorks or doing skill point farming, which admittedly is like not profitable anymore, by the way, depending on how and when you do it. But because of those mechanics, I think that is the reason it breaks it. But if you remove like the reasons to have 20 to 50 accounts as a single player, then we're just talking the players who are hyper committed, who have like 3 to 7 accounts. I feel more comfortable giving those players more of a voice than your casual player with a single account, because they're more invested, they're more connected with the community, they're likely to have a more informed vote, in my opinion. This is a bit of a hand-wavy argument, so to speak. But like, if you consider even looking at wormhole voters versus what used to be the average nullsec voter, the average nullsec voter used to only be one account. Then as capitals became more of a thing because the player base aged before skill injectors, suddenly had 2 accounts, right? Because you had your capital alt. And then a few would have 3 accounts because they also had a super alt. And the wormhole voters, on the other hand, wormhole PvP is heavily multi-boxed. And so they would have 3 to 5 to 6 voting accounts that they would use. And I felt like that was a good balance where the amount of investment you put into the game was reflected in how much your vote was worth. But because skill injectors, skill farming, and Rorquals have made it viable to have 30 to 50 accounts and not have you be just a crazy high sec miner, I feel like that is the issue, not necessarily how easy it is to vote for the CSM with those 30 to 50 accounts.
Might make an interesting poll. What do you guys think?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Speaking of, what was our poll last week, and what were the results?
Oh, do you want to go into that right now?
Let's do it.
CCP Pellagra releasing Botter Alliance affiliation. Your options were long overdue or bad call. This is based on the rather heated debate Ian and I had in the previous episode. A 50-50 split with more votes than we've had in a while. Our audience is completely divided on this issue.
Yep, and I think so was our panel.
So I don't think there's any easy answer going to this issue anytime soon. But yeah, I mean, Lave, what have you seen on the botting front as far as fallout related to Pellagra's decision? I don't really. Seems like there hasn't really been much of anything.
No. At least from my point on the mountain.
There was a lot of drama, and there was a lot of political spinning, and it was used as a way to hype up the Imperium when they first deployed the tribute. That's the only fallout. Like, it was used for political machinations. period, end of story. If that hadn't have happened, yeah, if that hadn't have happened, players would have found another excuse. So it literally, it had, apart from players seeing the writing on the wall and being like, yo, if you continue down this path, this could be very problematic, it has had zero impact. Well, I say it could be very problematic. That is a contentious or a controversial opinion. It is my personal opinion that this path is problematic. I personally would have voted that this was a bad call if I voted in our polls, which I don't, because I feel like that's sort of not a thing that I should be doing as a host. But
yeah.
I digress.
Leigh, where would you have voted if you had to?
On the poll about long overdue or bad call?
Yeah.
Again, I think at the time we discussed it, I thought that the approach was ham-fisted. It was clumsy. I mean, I don't disagree with Bottas getting absolutely pwned. And then I do remember, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, that a couple of Titans were transported to the perimeter gate in Jeddah and flagged suspect. I was very salty that I missed such the occasion. I wish they'd do that far more. Honestly, I don't think I could really come on one side or another completely. I do agree that we should be kept in loop about how many Bottas are being done, and I think that public executions of Bottas should happen often. They are an amusing aside to the game. But naming and shaming historical data over time itself isn't representative of the full meta and doesn't solve the current problems that we have.
Fair enough. Speaking of the botting problem, let's talk about Nullsec. Ha ha!
It's on fire.
Yeah, actually, we've had a ton of conflict lately. Tons to talk about since we haven't had a show for a little bit. Let's start in Providence. Spectre Fleet came out and said, hey, we are going to do not purple shoot it versus not red don't shoot it. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing, and it's also not an interesting thing. In a sense, Spectre Fleet has been fighting Providence forever, because they've been, you know, involved in their conflicts quite regularly with their pickup fleets and their bombing fleets, etc., etc. They get roamed quite often. But on the other hand, Spectre is now actually attacking structures and creating timers for Sov and Citadels in EU time zones, which is something that Pravi hasn't really had happen to them in a while. Certainly not defensively. So there is an element to that. Honorable Third Party and the Wrecking Crew are also still involved, still pushing on Providence timers and still getting pushed back by Providence in a rather amusing set of fights against the Capitalist Army hostile Freeport in 9UI. The Freeport trade hub for people that are attacking and roaming Providence. And I would open it up to Providence too, but they keep trying to reinforce it. So, you know, can't do that.
I'm still stunned that thing stands.
Holy shit, dude. It's been months. Months, and it's still alive.
I feel like if you had looted the field from all of the, like, fights you've had on that grid, you would have paid for the Fortizar by now.
Well, in terms of ships directly destroyed as a result of it existing, it has paid for itself about five times over, at least. At least. Now, I don't think we've looted enough ISK off the field to pay for it by any stretch, but in terms of, like, your ship being worth it if you kill more than it cost, yeah, it's good. Good trade.
You've heard of content writers. Have you heard of the content Fortizar?
And a shameless shill pitch. If you are interested in roaming the Providence area or you're in Spectre Fleet listening to this, please stop by. We are fully stocked for all your needs. You need more torpedoes, more bombs, replacement ship? We got it all. So just or maybe you're just looking for a place to hide. CVA is chasing you down, you know? Dock up, enjoy a cool beverage.
Repair,
say hi.
Your ship, repair your heat damage.
Yeah. Buy some paste so you can
stage a cap.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You can stage caps there. We've got fuel and ammo for Cap, so if you want to get in on that, you totally can. Fighters for sale, if you're into carriers.
I found it hilarious. A few of the Noir dudes were just out of the blue decided, hey, let's go down. Or actually, it was Vice who contacted me. I think he was sort of organizing the whole thing. He's like, hey, late USTZ, you guys want to just go and roam Delve now that the Goon Swarm or the Imperium Super Capital Fleet is deployed up north? And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. And so I was roaming down there. I was HKing in a rapier. And I go through this system, and I get randomly convoed by the snuff dude, saying like, wow, dude, thanks for spooking my target. I respond back like, sorry, there was no way I could have known, but good luck in your hunt. And then I roam through some space, and I'm on the way back through, and I see his dude in local again, and he convos me again, and he links me the kill mail of a Nidhogger, which he just solo dropped in a dread. So the snuff dude just solo dropped his dread onto a ratting Nidhogger in Delve and killed it and got out. Delve is freaking weird right now, dude.
It was on fire just for the first few days after the Goons announced their State of the Union. Like, as mentioned, we had Titans dying. We had Titans dying in one DQ, which would be otherwise unthinkable. And I think there was more damage done in Delve over the first week or so of the Imperium deploying. And I'm pretty sure if you were to look at the kind of numbers of how much the Imperium has killed, in tribute with their entire force versus what about 100 guys have done in Delve, I think they're about even right now.
So the numbers before the Keepstars and Asotios died in tribute were at around a trillion ISK destroyed by the Imperium up north. Tack onto that two keep stars, Asotio, and the extra stuff that's died since then. I think you're around 2 trillion destroyed up north by now. And then, of course, we would be remiss to not mention the fact that Sov getting reset means indexes get reset, means the space is not going to be back up to fully functional until at least a month after the Imperium leaves. So there is also that aspect, which is difficult to translate directly into ISK destroyed. But I'd say, I'm not too sure. I remember the last time the Imperium undeployed, it was around 3 trillion ISK destroyed.
Well, it seems to be the pattern. They'll go up north. North will send roamers south to farm their war calls and stuff, rinse and repeat. At this point, I don't think the Imperium really needs to care, to be honest. And this is the reason why. As cool as watching the ISK war is, and it definitely is, I still think ISK destroyed is meaningful. But with the amount of supercapital dominance the Imperium has, and the amount of economic output they are able to put out, it's not just the amount of ISK destroyed that's important, it's also ISK destroyed relative to ISK generation. And I think what the Imperium is doing is severely kneecapping an opponent who already can't match them economically. And I don't think the response is slowing down their economic engine meaningfully enough. It's a satisfying counterpunch. It feels good. But in terms of the strategic landscape of the game, I actually think it is a net win for Goonswarm, even if the numbers are strictly even, which they're probably not going to be by the end of it.
100%, it is a net win for the Imperium. Yep. There is no question. Anybody trying to tell you otherwise is spinning their brains out.
Yep. the North has not committed supers to this. The supers are not engaging in this because they cannot match the super numbers from the Goons alone. And the Goons moved up. There were some screenshots going around. There were some assertions whether that might have been faked a little bit, but anyone who watched it saw hundreds of Titans. And then from a subcap point of view, the North generally gets outformed by Goons, sometimes up to 5-1 against in terms of numbers. The Goons are going to win this one. It's going to be a case of the Goons basically taking tribute, probably taking Vale and various other areas. The question will be, can they keep it? Because I think the North just has to take this one on the chin.
Well, the interesting thing to me will be, to what extent do various SIGs from the Imperium stay behind to continue up harassment campaigns? Because the Imperium has no use for the space. Right, they've already got farming going on for renters down in Period Basis, out in Fountain. They're crabbing themselves in Delve heavily, in Aquarius, and in Fountain. Also got Cloud Ring for various entities that are sort of more loosely Imperium tied. Many would call them pets, but that's a loaded term nowadays. So, well, I don't think it's ever not been loaded, but in any case, they don't need the space. Space in Eve is no longer scarce, even though it's limited, because you can get so much out of a little bit of space nowadays with the iHub upgrades or with the SOV upgrades. So the Imperium doesn't care about that space. The only thing they care about is denying that space to the North, to PanFam in particular. And so it'll be interesting to me to see if they continue to leave SIGs behind, or rather if SIGs on their own, of their own volition, see this as an opportunity to generate content for themselves, and how that impacts things long term. It's if the North can recover, or if this is sort of like, once the infrastructure is gone, the SIGs are enough pressure to prevent it from being built back up.
I mean, Imperium being what it is, they could put a Athanor on every worthwhile moon in both all the regions they're attacking, and then farm those timers for continued fights and content long after they draw all the way back.
I don't think that's the case, because they're going to have to undeploy their super fleet, and without their super fleet there to protect the Rorquals or whatever mining those Athanors, the Athanors are just, they're going to die eventually.
No, no, no. They don't need to mine them at all. Just put them there.
The Athanors would get killed. Like, if you move the Imperium super fleet out, then the North can move their super fleet in, and then the North can win, even if they're outnumbered by subcaps by the Imperium. The Imperium moving their super cap fleet up north is what is letting them do this. When they deploy their super fleet, the North will have an advantage to be able to kill off any major structures. The question is, can the North then build back up their own structures under any extraneous pressure that remains?
But if you're the North, would you commit your supers to, say, 100 Athanor timers?
You don't have to. You only have to commit them to the ones that are contested.
But it's your habitat.
Also, just the threat being there would mean that they're likely not to be contested.
I mean, also consider us, this kind of leads us into Skill Yourself, an alliance that holds the Oasis and Peregrine Falls area, which has announced that they're going to fold. They own pretty much those both areas, and they sit currently to the northeast of Gemini area as well. So that opens up a bit of room potentially behind the lines, if you will, towards the east, which could become either vacant or is going to become hotly contested.
Yeah, Skilia disbanding is something we should probably talk about, because that's going to have some pretty significant impact on pretty much everything going on in the East. Skilia, one of the larger PvP alliances in the East, certainly one of the most highly skilled, claiming they, quote, don't want to go out like Pandemic Legion and leave on a high note. So they are disbanding now, and there's a lot of speculation on what's going to happen to the regions they control and their allies.
Skill Yourself and Hard Knocks together as the Holy Rental Empire were literally the largest rental empire in Eve by a long shot. Like, you could combine all of the Imperium stuff together plus the PanFam rental holdings, and together you would barely beat out how much the Holy Rental Empire controlled. So it is a massive amount of space that had some renters in it. Unfortunately, the way that they did their rental programs, I didn't have public info to parse to see how much of it was being actively used. So we don't know how much of that has renters looking for a new home now, but it is definitely a lot of space that could be rented out that is now has no owner, or soon will have no owner.
And one also has to consider that in terms of the geography of NullSec areas, Tribute's rubbish, because it's really good for logistics. It's in bridge range for dreads, for jump freighters to high sec really easily. But that same distance also makes it very easy to attack from low security. You know, if your Rorqual gets tackled, a dread bomb is legitimately a low sec undock away. Areas like Delve, on the other hand, are typically far safer because most of it is so far away geographically from low sec that any force has to base itself low in null security itself. In most cases in Delve, it will it will stage within the NPC areas of Del itself. Now, if for example, the north ended up going outwards towards Soeis and Peregrine Falls, for example, that's so much further from Empire, if you will. Logistics gets a bit harder, but it also gets a bit more tricky for hostile entities to drop large dread bombs on you without moving a sizable force elsewhere. So it could be interesting, but as you say, it's a lot of territory that could be going up for grabs very soon.
And it would be naive for us to assume or to insinuate that there are not already deals in place between Brothers of Tangra and what are they called? RMT, Rate My Ticks. Between those groups and the other groups who own the drone regions, like, there are existing deals in place to keep that rental space stable, because that is what renters want. They want stable crabbing space. So it is likely that it's not like this stuff is just suddenly being dropped into nowhere and nobody has inroads to gain control over another group. If I were a betting man, I would say that a significant portion of the space will be attempted to be picked up by bot. Some of it may go to Hard Knocks if they choose to expand their space. Fraternity, if they get finished with their war down south, they'll maybe try and expand out that way as well. I doubt the Imperium will make any significant push as a whole for this. Maybe some SIGs will go out there for content. But there is definitely already some political alignment with that space simply due to its proximity to other rental empires and thus the necessity to have deals in place to keep that rental space stable.
Yeah, I mean, there may be deals. In fact, I would assume that there are, but there's also groups that are unlikely to be involved in those deals, thinking Tri, thinking Unspoken. These are alliances that have been picking away at the edges of the drone regions for a long time now, and they're probably politically on the outside from a skill you disband. They might see this as an opportunity to expand their own holdings for themselves, and probably not in a friendly manner.
I would expect maybe Slice to do that. Triumvirate is a bit weird because they survive on content, and so I feel like going out to the drone regions being isolated would maybe prevent them from getting the content that they desire. But definitely Slice, who recently was kicked from GOTG, and moved into Inthirium Reach, which is also where Tri happens to be. I wouldn't be surprised if they maybe made a play for a region in the drone regions.
Well, speaking of the East, we should also talk about Deterrent in the Southeast.
Indeed.
Massive fight.
Multiple massive fights. It's really been heating up. It was a stalemate for a while due to Sino Jammers, and then it was a skirmish like just heaven. So Elo Knight and Origin Dot joined Fraternity proper, like they moved the entire corporation into Fraternity, and it sort of gave them a USTZ. And so it has just been fights over Rorquals, essentially. And then campaigns started spinning up where both sides were dropping Fortizars and other Citadels into the other side space. So Legacy would drop Fortizars in Deterrid, Fraternity would drop Fortizars in Tenerifus or Amensi, and they would basically fight over killing those to prevent the enemy from getting a beachhead. And what has happened is a couple of major, significantly large fights happened over those Fortizars. And indeed, after some of those Fortizars went up, Legacy actually managed to destroy the first iHub in Deterrid. And it happened in some interesting circumstances, because the fight that eventually led them to winning that first iHub timer started out by a Ragnarok accidentally jumping instead of bridging.
Did he say jump?
Yeah, so that fight basically, though, it's amusing because the Titan that jumped didn't even have a Sino fit. So the way it went down, there are videos posted to various forums that you can go and check out. But this Titan bridged through, or pardon me, jumped through instead of bridged, and got tackled. And it took a little bit, right? Fleets joined on field, but he didn't have a Sino. So Legacy could not jump in their faxes and their supers to save him. And so Fraternity jumped in a massive capital fleet to kill him, but then eventually Sinos got in place and then Legacy jumped in their super capital fleet and basically wiped the floor with the Winter Coalition capital fleet. And so it was something like 300 bill in total with around 100 bill lost for the legacy side and 200 bill for the fraternity side, the Winter Coalition side. It was a massive brawl. But as a result of that brawl happening, and happening when it happened, the timer, the iHub timer that was also happening at the same time, was won by Legacy. There's some intricacies that are being glossed over there, but that's the basic gist of it.
It is quite a sordid affair. Multiple escalations, a lot of twists and turns, which is great. It's awesome to see dynamic conflict back in the game. Especially in contrast to what's going on up north, which is fairly predictable in how it's playing out. At least that's my view.
Well, part of that is a self-fulfilling prophecy, though, right? The North said, hey, you guys are coming up, we can't defeat you, so we're not even going to try. So it's more of the North isn't trying to actively defend that space because they don't think they could win if they did. And so they're just sort of doing, we're going to take our wins when we can get them, but other than that, we're going to retreat and just do our thing and let you guys structure grind. So part of the North being as predictable as it is a self-fulfilling prophecy of people acting based on their own assumptions and not trying to contradict those assumptions. Whereas in the South, both sides think they can win, and so both sides are willing to fight very viciously for it.
Mm-hmm. But Nullsec isn't the only place with a lot of hot action. We were also seeing some shots fired in Losec, particularly Placid region. Ooh, what a barn burner of a fight for Losec, man. We got caps involved, we've got Titans getting dropped, there's a Fortizar, and all told, almost 300 billion lost for a Losec brawl. That is pretty rare. Okay.
I was going to say, we should clarify that this fight was between Snuffed Out and mainly Iron Armada. So the Fortizar belonged to Iron Armada. They were defending it. If I recall correctly, it was an armor timer. And so Iron Armada had some friends, Snuffed Out had some friends. And that is what sort of sparked this brawl over the armor timer on a Fortizar.
Yeah, it looked like Snuff and Pen is out versus Iron Armada and Shoot First. And with, like, a million different groups on each side in various numbers besides that.
I'm rather disappointed. There was a phenomenal AAR. Phenomenal in the sense of the tactical information that was given in the timeline. It was given from the defender's perspective, right? So there was some bias in there. But that's to be expected. So essentially what happened was Iron Armada was there. They were defending this Fortizar. They figured it was going to die, but they put it up to get content, so they were going to fight for it anyway. So Snuff jump in, and they have their MAC fleet, and they support it with Fax. And Iron Armada go in, they have their fleet, but they don't have Fax. Unfortunately, they can't break the Fax reps of the Snuffed Out subcat fleet, so they drop a few dreads to kill the Fax, and then Snuffed Out counter drops with more dreads to kill the Iron Armada dreads. And then Iron Armada drops the rest of their capitals to wipe out the Snuff caps. And then Snuff drops Titans to wipe out the Iron Armada caps. And then finishes off the Fortizar because nobody can escalate with supers against Snuff and Losec.
Not yet.
Not ever.
I mean, not ever, yeah. It's just probably not going to happen.
If there was ever an I win button in Eve, it was Snuff dropping supers in Losec right now.
Well, it's really interesting, because it didn't just happen overnight. A lot of people shit on Snuff, and, you know, they got reasons. For one thing, they seem to be really unreliable allies. But on the other hand, they made a brilliant tactical decision, deciding to align themselves with the Imperium, get a little bit of Nullsec space to build up this advantage, and now they're going back into low, and now they've got the biggest dick.
I'm a fan of Snuff being the bad guys. I think Eve needs more bad guys, and I'm glad Snuff is willing to stand up and be that bad guy.
You're selling penis, my dear Smetani.
I'm waiting for the first group, because since people, I think, have forgotten the massive change that happened to Fax reps and diminishing returns. So, like, theoretically, you could dread bomb the Snuffed Out super fleet. And win handedly, but nobody's tried it yet.
Well, I mean, there was a fair amount of dreads in this fight. They just didn't live long.
Well, yeah, and the Dreads were dropped first. So presumably the Titans and Supers would have come in at an advantageous position to utilize their extra range in order to avoid getting turned on in any meaningful fashion by the other Dreads.
Lave?
Yeah, I don't, as you say, no particular entity has yet instigated that huge kind of Dread on Super Brawl where that's really been tested. That said, honestly, the typical EVE game, EVE player will simply just treat it like any other equation. They'll just say, okay, well, we need to drop like 8 more faxes, but then for a super pilot, that shouldn't be an issue. And I think it's representative of the oppressive nature of supers in general right now. The fact that they are the I win button, and they're basically an unkillable I win button. That's my biggest problem with Titans. I don't have a problem with the Doomsdays or the firepower or the fact they got jump generators. It's just that you can't realistically kill them without something ridiculously overwhelming on your side or bad luck. Honestly, I'd remove the EHP multipliers from all supers and Titans, though, for the plates and shield extenders.
Well, that's definitely an interesting solution. I think there might also be, because it's not just the ships themselves, it's also how they operate in groups. You could do something interesting with, for instance, the range around a sino at which ships appear. Maybe make them more likely to bump and bounce. Maybe mess with that so that they bounce further. The more spread out they are, the less effective fax reps would be on them.
It's also worth noting that just add more fax doesn't work anymore with diminishing returns. You will reach a point where the fax don't matter, where adding more dreads is significantly better than adding more fax, and that is why dread bombs could now work.
Yeah, as you say, though, this particular engagement was a trickle engagement. One side trickled in apart. Had they have all thrown down on the table straight away, all the Titans come in on the first wave, then I think you're probably more likely to see some dead supers. But that's just it. They held back their hammer until the very last thing, until they probably were convinced, and Snuff have a great intelligence network. They'll know who's going to come after them anyway, so they'll know the forces in the area, and they won't have dropped that without knowing that no one else in the area could challenge them.
Yep. Yeah, their intel network is a really important component of this conversation, shouldn't be understated. You can see them coming for you, and you're not there. Yeah, the Superfleet's not going to die. All right, moving on. Not player-related content. So the least exciting thing that we could possibly talk about, but also relevant because it has definitely impacted the game in some interesting ways, and there's also some new shiny stuff that may be killing players very shortly. Triglavian invasion has happened. This is basically Sanchez incursions, but with Triglavian ships, but with some also important differences as well. And they are now dropping new content in terms of new ships. There's also a few new, I think, plasmid types, but really we're here for the ships. So Artemis, you have run some of these PvE sites, would love to hear your take, and then Lave and I are going to go over these new ships and some interesting applications of them.
Yeah, so it's worth noting that even now, like, was it been 3 weeks since release, since the patch of the invasions patch, the PvE content isn't complete. It isn't fully released yet. And that's because what TCP is doing is they didn't put everything on the CC ahead of time so that they could do the regular bug fixing and everything. They wanted to maintain the mystery surrounding the Triglavians, and so they're sort of releasing it piecemeal and bug fixing as they go, which is making things very interesting and very buggy if you try it the first day it's out. But it also means that the content isn't complete yet. We still have only had these invasions. They can go up to like 3 stages. We still have only seen an invasion in its first stage, and we haven't even gotten to the end of a first stage yet. So there are multiple types of, they're called conduits, which are essentially like your various types of sites in regular old incursions. And we have the minor ones, which are for 1 to 3 players, and the major ones, which are for 5 to 6 players. But there are even larger ones, which we don't have access to yet, and then the invasion still has to go through its other 2 stages. So this content is still not fully released yet. We still don't have a full grasp of what it could be in total. But right now, initially when it launched, it was extremely easy. But CCP has since significantly buffed just all of the rats in general. They all do more damage, they all tank more, their EWAR is stronger, they're faster, etc., etc. So if you tried this day one, thought, wow, this is way too easy, I'm done, go back and try it again, lose a couple ships, then realize it's not that easy. I say that because I tried it live on stream on PIS this week and lost a couple of basilisks. So that was fun.
Oops.
But basically, they have extremely heavy EWAR, and it's genuinely fun. Like, the battleships in these sites, you have to scram them, because if they're getting low on HP, they'll MJD away from you. They'll run. If you warp in at a ping, they will MJD out and then warp down on top of you, the entire enemy fleet. The fleets will, usually they'll orbit you right around 30 kilometers, just the whole group will be in a 30 kilometer sphere around you, with various ships being at various ranges depending on the weapon systems, right, because Starglavians are short range things. But they definitely will utilize ranges, they'll come in on you if you try to kite, they'll MJD away if they're about to die, and it's some interesting new content. They've got a bunch of extremely powerful EWAR with them. The newts in particular are the real killers. That's how everything died. At least the basilisks, is because we only had two, and they newted out the Bazzy cap chain. And that was the end of it.
Oof.
Do they still have those weird bugs? I remember looking at them on day one, and the Leshaks had something like 7 disruptor models on them. So, like, 7, it looked very, very odd. They just had these bubbles, like, kind of like tumors coming out of them.
I don't know about those bugs. I suspect that they would be fixed, because CCP is heavily, like, as stuff is released, they're getting patched. So when the major conduits first released, they didn't work. You couldn't finish them. You could never complete a site. Like, new waves wouldn't spawn. And so then CCP removed all the sites. They stopped spawning anymore. They fixed some things, brought them back. They were still broken a bit. And now it seems like the major conduits are working as intended. So it is definitely something that is not only we're gaining access to new content over time, so we haven't seen all the content there is to offer, but also as bug fixes happen and balance patches happen, this content is constantly changing. So don't just try it once and think, okay, I understand what this has to offer and it's not for me, because we don't even know what all it has to offer, and it's consistently changing.
Overall, your rating for this new content compared to, say, previous live events and also compared to incursions. Maybe give 2 separate ratings. How do you rate this in terms of worthwhile to do, difficulty, and overall cool factor?
Ooh. So I wasn't around when incursions first came out. So I wasn't there for the whole like process of solving incursions. I only was involved with them after they were a solved problem. So as far as cool factor and difficulty and all that jazz, invasions right now are much better because they're not a solved problem yet. They're an open question, so to speak. As far as versus other live events, I like this one significantly better. If it weren't for all of the bugs, if it weren't for the fact that the content is coming out and then having to be taken away and brought back out again, right? You can't fully explore the content because it's broken on release a significant portion of the time, which is understandable, right? That's sort of required when CCP can't put this stuff on a test server because that would spoil the mystery. So I understand it's sort of a trade-off that CCP has to make, and I'm glad they're making that trade-off because I feel like it gives the payoff to the players who care about the lore and such, and the players who care about solving these problems. They're not going to be able to solve the problems right now anyway because we don't have the full picture. So I am overall happy with the way that CCP is doing invasions, and I'm waiting till I see the full picture to see what the hardest difficulty of these invasion sites is going to be before I can properly compare them to incursions. So we don't know if it's going to be worthwhile to run them yet, because we don't know what all you can do in them yet.
Well, we do know what's out right now. Value-wise.
Right now is you can make ISK. It's sort of right now the highest level stuff you can do. You can get like VNI ticks running it.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and you also get like officer mod drops from the officers that spawn on the sites. They're rare, the drops themselves. You also get the new mutoplasmids. The salvage has the new stuff for the building the new T2 components. The LP store has a very valuable item that you need in order to do invention on the Trig ships now. It has the data cores that you need. And so it is a lot of
a lot of stuff that is definitely going to be valuable for you from the LP store, in addition to a bunch of cool new skins. If you're a person who flies the, you know, new Triglavian ships that were just released.
Speaking of those new ships, let's get into it. I'm really excited about these, in particular the Assault Frigate. So let's start there. The Nurgle. We talked about it a little bit when it was first announced as a concept, but we have since gotten a look at the numbers. And I've been messing around with fits with it for a little while, and I'm pretty sure I have one that I'm happy with, at least happy enough to take it out into the live server. Bonuses, much like its T1 cousin, it's a 5% light entropic disintegrator damage bonus and a 4% resistance bonus to armor. The Assault Frigate bonuses. 20% bonus to the maximum damage multiplier for the entropic disintegrator and a 7.5% bonus to maximum range. Now the range one is interesting. It's nice to have. I don't actually think it gives you a lot. You can fight outside of web range if you wanted to, but you can't fight outside of point range meaningfully. At least not without making some serious fitting compromises, right? But it's there. It also gets a 50% reduction in micro warp drive SIG radius penalty like any assault frigate. Can fit the assault damage control like any assault frigate. Like any of the trig ships, it has a 50% reduction in smart bomb cap, remote repair cap, nuke cap, and a 100% bonus to remote armor rep range for smalls. Because it's looking fit. In terms of attributes, you know, nothing too interesting. It does have a 5 drone bay, which is pretty cool. It's slot layout 2-3-4, so 2 highs, 3 mids, 4 lows. Obviously the 1 turret hard point like any trig ship, 2 rig slots like any tech 2 ship. I'm pretty jazzed about it, actually. I like it. It's like the best parts of a Ishkur, Retribution, and Vengeance all rolled up into one.
And it does like 1,000 DPS.
Not quite that much.
It's not that much.
I'm being hyperbolic. What's the actual...
The DPS is great. It's, you will easily exceed a blaster fit Thorax. Easily.
If you have a Colton with no damage mods with a T2 and a Nurgle, you can top out about 500 DPS plus with your turret. And that's notwithstanding that without any damage mods or drones. Or
and you're going to want to put a damage mod in it, realistically.
And especially because that damage mod increases your cycle time, or your rate of fire rather, which in turn decreases the amount of time it takes you to reach that highest DPS.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the biggest weakness of the new T2 ships, the Nurgle and the hack version as well, is that they basically can go to about twice the they can go up another kind of set of levels in terms of how they ramp up, but this particular ship takes 2.5 minutes to get to full DPS.
I actually think in this case the frigate doesn't suffer as much from the drawback as the cruiser version does, which we'll get to in a second. For two reasons. One, the cycle time is much faster on the smaller gun variant. And the other one is it doesn't really have a lot of competition at that level. When you're talking about a hack, your points of comparison aren't really other Tech 1 cruisers. I mean, you could do that if you wanted to. But mostly when you're talking hacks, the primary competition in the game is T3 cruisers and battle cruisers. The more expensive version of the T3s, the cheaper version of the battlecruisers, but all of them have similar kind of things going on. In terms of the battlecruisers, you're looking at their range, you're looking at the tank a little bit, and you're looking at their damage. When you're talking about their comparisons to the T3 cruisers, you're usually talking about the damage, the tank, and the speed. And a little bit the range, depending on how you are fit. With the Assault Frigate, that isn't as much a thing. There's the, like, your competition is really the Tech 3 destroyers, and that's about it. And I don't think there's any... Like, there's no Tech 3 destroyer that really comes into this niche. So I think the Assault Frigate shines a little bit brighter in some ways compared to the cruiser. Now, obviously, it's still a frigate, so you can't expect miracles. It's tank, you know, especially if you do put in the damage mod, which I would recommend. You're still looking at, like, somewhere between 10 to 12k effective hit points without the damage control turned on. That's not awesome. Unlike some other assault frigates that I compared it to, it is a bit slower. So it basically has the speed of a Vengeance, but the damage, many more times the damage potential of a Retribution, slightly less range, and then you've got the drone bay of the Ishker. It's a very unique mix. I really like it. I came up with a dual prop fit that has a remote rep and a damage mod, and you can't run the rep for very long, but it's still there, which is pretty cool. You can run it for like a minute and a half, maybe a little bit less if you're running other stuff too. And that's pretty good. That's a lot to give your Logi a little bit of a boost, you know, or get your guy repped up while you're waiting for that damage ramp to happen. It also enables you to potentially, if you're roaming around in small numbers, not have to worry about putting a guy in a logistic ship, period. If you're only planning on taking out ratters and stuff like that, you just need a little bit of rep to make sure that you get the clean kill, then I think this is a really good option for you. The dual prop is nice because you can still keep that speed with the micro warp drive, but at the same time, if you get into that scram range to really unlock that Tech 2 close range ammo damage, and you get scrammed back, you're still good. You're still pretty mobile. Lave, do you want to take us to the Ikatursa?
Yeah, the Iki is a bit of another strange one. Just to run people through the headline figures of it, this ship can top out over 1,000 DPS without any damage mods, which is insanity. The difficulty, or rather its drawback, is the time it takes to get to there. So let's just run through it. It's the Heavy Assault Cruiser version again with four high slots, so one turret, three utility high. It has four mid slots, so a good complement there, but it won't be shield tanking anytime soon. And it has six lows with the typical two rigs. Typically speaking, this ship itself is pretty fast in terms of its straight line speed. Now, if you run this under an armor hack, kind of an NAB version, no one does that these days anyway, this thing, even with a bit of a plate on it, with a bit of care, can even easily exceed 700, even 800 meters a second. And a micro warp drive, it's fast as well. And again, it gets a range bonus to its weapons. So Mystic, which is the long-range ammunition, you could be touching 45 kilometers, which is about pulse range of a Zealot and a bit more. In terms of its damage potential, as mentioned, this thing can, you know, spin up all the way to 1,000 DPS and goes, well, even with a single damage mod, to 1,200 DPS. The problem is it takes about 4 minutes to get there, even 223 seconds with single damage mod. There's a long time for your DPS to be getting up there, and you start at about 310 DPS with a Colt, and then it just ramps up from there. So this... It's a bit of a strange ship, this one. I mean, with regards to your comments earlier about the Nurgle, I mean, I have to say it's got less... The Nurgle has less range than Retribution, and it's certainly faster than the Vengeance, at least what I've seen. This particular ship itself, again, has about equal, if not slightly greater range than a Zealot under Pulse, though, of course, won't ever beat the beams. But one of the great advances about entropic disintegrators is their tracking. This thing tracks evil. It sits between a short range and a long range weapon, and given the numbers of utility highs you've got for a remote rep, you know, you could run a version of this with under a full remote rep configuration with Sentier type small armor reppers, and each ship will rep itself for about 470 DPS cap stable, that kind of thing. You can do some really interesting things with them. I think the time it takes for it to get to its absolute top DPS is what maybe makes it less desirable in the current meta right now. Let's say against Munins, for example, which apply all of their DPS straight away.
I think it's not just the current meta. This is what I was talking about where it goes to comparison. So even if you would do a one-to-one between the Ikatursa and, say, the Drekovic, which is the Triglavian battlecruiser, their range is similar. Obviously, the Ikatursa is going to be much faster. The Drekovic is going to be slightly tankier. That's the main trade-off between the two. The Ikatursa also has that tracking bonus, which is kind of nice against smaller targets. But the tracking is pretty good, as you mentioned, base. Thing is, the Ikatursa will not actually start out damaging the Drekovic until about 5 minutes in. And then it will take you another 2-ish minutes to make up the amount of DPS that you would have had in those 5 minutes while you were spooling up. 7 minutes is a long time to shoot one target without switching.
Yep.
You're basically talking shooting cap ships, and that is about it.
Yeah, I can see the Nurgle being useful in kind of Stuka kind of fleets, which rely on small ships going through wormholes, for example, because you have a frigate which can potentially put out more DPS than a bomber. But the same principle, the same problem here is that the bomber will be doing far more DPS over time anyway, and has the advantage that it can shoot bombs. Now, these things, these things will be very strong, certainly one-on-ones versus their classes, but I think that they certainly have enough drawback as to make them not god mode, but they are. So if you go one-on-one with one at close range, like going short-ranging in one of these ships is near suicide in a one-on-one.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, that is one of the best uses that people have thought of it for, Abyssal PvP sites. It has really no natural predator other than another Ikatursa.
You say that. I don't know if it's just people are bad at piloting, but I suspect it's rather that it's less simple than many would have suggested before the patch happened. There was a massive post on Reddit that blew up that like the Ikatursa was going to just ruin Abyssal PvP. It was going to be the I win button, you couldn't beat it. But Ikatursas are still dying, and they're dying in the hands of good pilots. And they're dying to Cerberuses and Orthruses that are fit with rapid lights for max damage. So the majority of the time, as I understand it, the way this happens is Ikatursas fit reactive hardeners. You do that so that if you get an Ikatursa matchup, you have the resists versus their damage, their thermal and explosive damage types. But what smart Cerberus and Orthrus pilots are doing is they're sending out their drones with a different damage type than their missiles. And so they'll do damage with the drones first to get the raw to the right damage type, or rather the wrong one relative to missiles, and then they're nuking the ship with the missiles. And so there is quite a bit of tactical counterplay that happens in any Ikatursa matchup, even up against, like, say, a Curse, which is also common. If you're in Abyssal PvP in a Gila, you're going to lose. Anything that enters Abyssal PvP arenas besides another Gila is built to kill Gilas. So if you're doing that, you're basically hoping that nobody else shows up. But the other stuff that goes in there, specifically Curses, Cerberuses, Orthruses, and Ikatursas, are all somewhat able to kill each other. The Ikatursa, I think, has an advantage the longer the fight goes on, right? So if that Orthrus or Cerberus does its first round and the Ikatursa pilot knows how to counter it, or doesn't make mistakes, or rather the Cerberus or Orthrus pilot makes mistakes, then the Ikatursa will win. But it's certainly not your average Joe could rock up into the Ikatursa with a 4-bill fit in Abyssal PvP and just win. Your average Joe is just going to lose his 4-bill Ikatursa.
I mean, clearly there's counterplay, but... And that actually is pretty ingenious, what you're describing.
Yeah, I've just linked the kill mail in a channel that I like.
But, like, strictly stats-wise, there's no true comparison.
I do want to take the tangent of the Stuka fleets back a little bit, because people have been using them. I initially stated when Kikimoras came out, and Initiative temporarily plugged Kikimoras into their Stuka fleets. I was terrified, because I saw that and I was like, well, great, nothing is going to survive now. But the Initiative stopped, and that was it for a while, and people were saying, you can't do it because there's not enough supply of Kikimoras. Well, nowadays, Pandemic Legion and WeForm Volta have come around and started using almost exclusively Kikimora fleets as Stuka fleets, and they are wreaking havoc with them. If you go on YouTube and search for Kiki Edit, there's a series. I think it's up to Kiki Edit 4 is the most recent one. But they are just demolishing cap fleets. They're able, because of the fighter nerfs, to stay on grid, even when super capitals are dropped on top of them. And it is genuinely phenomenal what you can do with just a full fleet of Kikis with a few bombers in there so you can use void bombs and such. But I think if you stick in the Dragger, which I'm sure we'll be talking about here in a minute.
Why don't you take it off there, Artemis?
Okay, so the Dragger is a command destroyer. It's basically a Kikimora with a little bit less various stats. Right, it has to have some downsides to it, but then it also has its tech 2 resists, a micro jump drive field generator, and the unique thing about it is that it can fit skirmish, or rather it is bonus to skirmish and info links. So that is the Draugr. It's basically a T2 Kikimora with a couple of drawbacks in various areas, but then you also get extra utility.
The most noticeable drawback is it does not have the range bonus that Kikimora does. I think that is probably the most stark for me, because the Kikimora's range is like, it's just perfect.
Well, the range itself, it can push to 45, which is insanity. I mean, that's basically beam retribution.
Yeah. My biggest disappointment with the Draugr is the slot layout, if you want to go over that.
I don't have it pulled up at the moment. Do you have it offhand?
I do. It is a 3 high, 3 mid, 4 low setup, which puts it basically where the Pontifex is at in terms of just not the best command destroyer for like spearfishing particularly. I think the command burst situation where you have skirmish and info at the same time means it's perfect for roaming fleets, because you get the bonus to your maneuverability and you get your bonus to e-war, and you're probably not going to be tanking too much, so the armor and shield bonuses are like whatever. But if you just want to put it in a spearfish fleet or a micro jump fleet in general, the fact that it can't fit the micro warp drive, the micro jump generator, a tackle mod, and a burst ECM kind of sucks.
Isn't that like the same slot layout as the frigate? 3 mids, 4 lows.
Yes, it is.
Though the frig doesn't have the micro jump thing.
Yeah.
Well, the frig has to give up that. The command destroyer has to give up a mid, obviously, to mount that particular side of things, so it can only ever have one tackle.
And having the Magus is just so good, because having that burst ECM in addition to your tackle mod is so nice.
Well, also, a spearfishing fleet like that, you're not going to put in a ship that's, you know, several hundred millions up at this point in time, versus, say, a Magus, which you can get fully fitted out for about 110 with a decent tank. And a Magus is a really good ship in terms of its slot layout.
Yep. Does pretty good damage, too, if you keep track of your drones and don't lose them.
Yeah, I saw a nice video from, I think it was Squishy, who used the Draugr to boosh off excavator drones. And then, of course, the Draugr has the firepower to actually kill them off in a reasonable amount of time.
Ooh, that reminds me. I meant to say when we were talking Abyssal PvP, if you want to see sort of the intricacies of the EE Tursa in Abyssal PvP, not necessarily its matchup versus the Orthrus and Cerberus, because they didn't have those fights, but definitely go and check out its, what's this guy's name? Gustav Manfred? G-U-S-T-A-V space M-A-N-N-F-R-E-D. Dude's got some fantastic Abyssal PvP videos, and his most recent one, Abyssal PvP Arena 10, has Iki Tursa in it. And he shows sort of what the 1v1 matchup looks like. He shows it versus some various other things. It's pretty cool.
Sweet.
Yeah, those covers are good.
He also, like, if you want to go into a backlog, he's got a Talisman Stratios that he uses, and other various nonsense. Like, this guy is an Abyssal PvP hardcore dude.
All right, let's move on, and let's try to close out this show with some host highlights and shoutouts. I want to give my highlight and my shoutout to my move. The move itself, not much of a highlight, but once I got here, it was a lot of fun. The area is cool. I'm like kind of in the LA area now. And I want to give a shout out to Sandor Inkura and NAR alumni. He's been really helpful in like getting me information about the area and stuff like that. So major props to him. And I'm also looking forward to being around other NAR folks. Like Delator isn't like in SoCal, but you know, close-ish, and I think there's a few other folks that are within driving distance, so that's going to be a lot of fun, and you know, it certainly makes getting to EVE Vegas a little bit easier every year, so really excited about that, looking forward to hanging out with these guys, looking forward to Vegas this year, looking forward to finally completing my move by finding a place to move to instead of living in a hotel.
My host highlight is being hero tackle for some brave YOLO cap kills. So when Horde deployed to SH1 for this northern battle thing, people have started getting more and more confident with what they're dropping around BWF and the Geminate area, because they're like, they don't expect a response fleet to happen. But in this particular case, Brave drops like 3 carriers on the Oige Gate in BWF. And they saw this, Flash formed a Ferox fleet to go encounter it, and they were just screaming for a Hick. Nobody had a Hick. And so I dropped my Drake, my Link Drake, bought a Onyx off contract, went in. I was the only Hick in field and managed to Hick point 2 of the caps and broadcast the one that had gotten bumped off the gate. And so he couldn't jump out. And it was sort of just a matter of keeping myself alive, right? Because I was the only tackle. And so I had to keep myself alive. There were some other Griffins that were on field that I had to broadcast, make sure they were killed because they were jamming me and things like that. And we managed to basically clean up the 3 caps. PL and Pandemic Core dropped a couple of supers on them, wiped the floor with them after we had them tackled. But it was really fun being the hero tackle again. And like afterwards, I literally had some of the super pilots DMing me on Discord saying, "Hey, good job with the hero tackle. Thanks." And like, yeah, feels good, man. It was genuinely a feeling I have not felt in a long time, because I haven't been hero tackle in a while, but it was fun and I enjoyed it, and it was my host highlight.
Leave.
My host highlight was running around the tribute area. Once used to be a home in MC, now it's basically Delve, because the goons were chasing my sector fleet with Titans, trying to boast on us and general shenanigans.
How rude.
I know.
Any shout outs, Leave?
It's kind of the limit. I've got a few people who kind of hung around recently in Horde. Great people. I think my big one right now would effectively be, I think, just everyone who's been involved with the CSM process who didn't vote for one of the big blocks, because I think that as we started on CSM, and I think it's appropriate that we finish on CSM, that we don't have the same thing of a null sec dominated, null sec interest gamer group trying to steer CCP in the direction that it wants to be. I think that's highly dangerous for the game, and I would commend and vote anyone who, like Adams, you vote for the people who stand to your interest, not necessarily how you've been told to vote. That's just like voting like a sheep.
Yeah, so Leave and I would say have a slight disagreement on that. So my shout out goes to everybody who voted for the CSM, but not just following their own like null blocks ballot, right? Because all the null blocks put out a ballot, they said, "Hey, vote by this in the order with the people." If you didn't follow that, if you used your brain, if you researched the candidate and actually voted for the people who benefited you, my shout out is to you. Now, if those players were null block candidates, that's fine with me. Right? Because if you're a null block player, you want to vote for null block candidates because they represent your interests. Even though, like Lave or myself and Alec, we're not necessarily null block players, even though we do work within the null block system and abuse the null block system, that gameplay, it doesn't necessarily represent our interests in Eve, so we may not be benefited by having those players on the CSM. But if you are a null block player, you are fully invested in that playstyle, and you voted for one of those candidates, good on ya. As long as you used your brain to realize that was the player who best represented you, it didn't just follow your freaking ballot put out by your group.
Well, I will once again reiterate that the best way to make sure that a small group of NullSec players does not dominate the CSM is to make sure that the small group of NullSec players aren't the only people voting for the CSM. There are plenty of non-NullSec candidates out there that are running. Not to say that some of the NullSec-based candidates shouldn't be the candidates that deserve your vote. There are plenty out there that do. I voted for quite a few of them myself. And whether you're in high-sec, low-sec, wherever, you may still find that a candidate's preferred area of play does not necessarily fully define them and may not fully define you either. That said, the best way to make sure that block voting isn't effective is to have blocks not control the majority of the vote. Right now, the various alliances have block ballots because they know that they can get their guys elected with the votes of their blocks. If that wasn't the case, you might have to have some kind of grand compromise NullSec ballot where all the NullSec alliances are voting for the same people rather than the coalition, because the coalitions wouldn't have enough folks. But until we get people from other parts of the game participating in this process, from faction warfare to wormholes to high sec guys. That's just not going to happen. So if you're listening to this show, go out and vote. Get your corp to vote. Get your alliance to vote, if applicable. Get your friend that you mine with to go check out these candidates and cast your vote. Make sure we get the best CSM possible this year. That's it, guys. Head to declarationswar.com for the poll. And Capitalist Army is recruiting. We can definitely use a few more good people. We had a recent nice influx of U.S. time zone folks, which is quite nice. Could definitely use a few more of those. And our European time zone is picking up quite nicely since the Bloc joined Templus Calcif. You'll not just have all the great European content that that Capitalist Army generates. Oh, Noir. But also a lot more alliance-based time zone ops, which means bigger fights. We had like a big graveyard of Macarials the other day. I just got all these pings from our Discord server because we have a channel where kill mails show up. And I'm just scrolling through pages and pages of Macarial kills. All European time zone. So if you want to be in on that, you want to be in our U.S. time zone small gang rooms, come on out, hit me up. We've got a Discord, we've got a chat channel. Come email me. We would love to talk to you and see if you're a good fit. Wherever you are, good hunting, listeners, and go vote.
Do it.